It's just the problem is like you can't have God die. You can't have, you need, Hazadisa needs to fulfill whatever his mission is. There's just these immovables. If Hazadisa dies, he can't go fulfill the mission.
Well, if it's immovable, it's immovable. The Christian contention is that a God who is not willing to die is not worth believing in.
How many Cadbury eggs do you have to eat to please Jesus, to satisfy the Easter dole? Is there a number? It's got to be at least three.
Well, technically,
because it's the Trinity, right? So one egg is Jesus, another egg is the Holy Ghost, and the other one is God. But together in your tummy, it's the Trinity.
No, the Trinity is one egg.
I don't think that's how it works.
See, there's a shell, there's a white, and there's a yolk.
I feel like this is getting three racist persons right now. So I'm a little uncomfortable with the conversation. Because you said there's a white.
But they're
like, that makes me nervous.
They're all one thing.
Okay.
They're all the same egg.
I don't know if that's true. Who is the egg expert? Who's the one who arbitrates on the eggs in Christianity? Is there a committee or a commission or?
Well, according to Christian theology,
is it in Cadbury at the temple there?
God made chickens, but did he make the egg?
It's like our kid-to-kid conversation. Okay.
Because we can most definitely say without any reservations whatsoever, in case you were wondering, that the chicken came first.
The chicken definitely came first.
Yes.
It wasn't the egg.
And at no point did it have anything to do with a dinosaur. I would like to stand firmly on the statement that Tyrannosaurus rexes and chickens coexisted.
They coexisted?
Yes.
Were,
and for a time,
the chickens
were peacefully,
right?
Yeah.
I was about to say, did the chickens oppress thee? Were they lording over the Tyrannosaurus?
Maybe not all the time, but you know, in the fullness of Jesus's upside down kingdom, the chickens did win.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
I mean, the evidence speaks for itself.
Well, there's a lot of evidence that dinosaurs were in fact simply created by Satan to confuse us anyway, so it makes sense that would be the case.
I think that goes without saying.
Yeah.
I think the idea, because it screws around with the timeline, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's a museum in Kentucky, I think,
mm-hmm.
with the boat.
Yeah.
And, which just seems like a lot of like a waste of wood, but it's okay. I would try not to let that bother me. But there's an evolution museum there.
Yeah.
And a creation museum, I think it's called.
Yeah. A creation museum.
And apparently dinosaurs were like domesticated animals mm-hmm. to humans.
Yeah, they have these kind of like reconstructions of dinosaurs on the Ark.
Yeah, and they were also like
a velociraptor that's kind of like helping take care of the babies or whatever.
There's a lot of like, they're like plowing the fields and things.
Yeah.
And so, but apparently the dinosaurs just, it was too much for them. So it was like sort of a mass, like a suicide pact that if it doesn't work out with humans, they just all die off.
I believe they died in the flood, John. Welcome to Crossing Faiths, where Christian and a Muslim talk religion and politics. I'm Elliot, and I'm here with John. And we had a very interesting topic planned, but I realized...
I had to remind you that it was Easter.
That it's Easter.
Weekend.
Yeah. So we can't talk about that. What we have to talk about is, what do Muslims believe about the resurrection?
What do Muslims believe about the resurrection?
Yeah.
There's three schools of thought. So one is that we'll start with the least believable is that within the Muslim world is that Jesus survived. The second is that so he didn't die on the cross. The most prevalent is that he ascended to heaven prior to dying. So in Islam, it's really sort of straight lines. So when you die, you die. So Jesus is coming back. So at the end of days, just like in Christianity, to open up a can on the Dajjal, which is the Antichrist. And so he's hanging around until the Mahdi comes, which is the temporal dude. And the two of them will then open up a can.
So one school of thought is that Jesus survived physically the resurrection.
Right. Which is the least sort of endorsed.
There are some interesting implications in that we might circle back to. The second is that he died on the cross.
No, there's no dying on the cross. So Jesus never dies.
Okay.
Jesus was a prophet.
So he was taken up to heaven?
Yeah, he just ascended.
Elijah
style, yeah, yeah. So like he there's different ways of describing it. Sometimes it's called an inoculation, which I just don't think that anybody understands what that word means. Enoch
walked with God and was
right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So the problem is that Jesus has a role to perform. Hazadis has a role to perform in Islam. The role is to counteract the Dajjal. In order to do that, he can't die. Right, so he has to still be alive. So theologically, he still has to be alive. Okay, so that's one. And so, the face of him, it appeared that he died, but it wasn't him. So that's the most prevalent. The third sort of way of looking at it is that it was changed out. So like Simon. When Simon carried the cross, he was switched out. There was a switch out, and somebody of his likeness, like Simon, looked like that. I mean, they were all popping beards at that time. I mean, who could do the math, and somebody else, volunteered, didn't pay for his sins, but volunteered to sacrifice themselves.
And what did Jesus do after that?
He ascended.
Right away?
Yeah.
That day?
I don't know the numbers, but yeah, in proximity of that time.
Like Simon was like hanging on the cross and watching Jesus ascend in the distance. This was like, well,
Simon was,
what I get.
I think Simon was dealing with his own troubles. I don't think he was watching much. You know, I feel like Simon.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the guy disappeared. You know, so.
Wait, so, sorry. I'm a little confused here. What's the distinction between the second and third schools?
One is that it was just sort of like an empty shell on the cross. It was nobody. It was just like a...
It was a human body without a soul.
It was like a... I don't know what it was. Like an embodiment. It was like a mirage.
Okay, like an illusion.
Yeah. Like... You know, I would think of like, look at a way, like a sort of a, in a very sci-fi sort of way, all of a sudden there, Hazadisa becomes, his role is not fulfilled, so he needs to ascend, right? And then you've got this sort of like sci-fi thing like that. What's that? Like a, all of a sudden this sort of mirage, this sort of image of him on the cross shows up.
And this is because in Islamic theology, it's impossible for Jesus to die and still fulfill his function.
Prophets have roles, and they have to fulfill their roles. And his role is to continue until until the end of days.
And so, physical bodily death precludes that.
Yep.
The fulfillment of that role.
Yep. And there's one God. It's Allah. That's it. You know, there's no.
Yeah,
none of this business.
He's a prophet.
Yeah, he's a prophet. And the closest you have to the Holy Ghost is Gabriel.
Yeah, okay.
So he was the breath of God.
Sticking to the cloth, the cross.
Yeah.
In Islamic theology, as you understand it, is there a function that is served by the cross, or is it just sort of like an inconvenient happenstance?
It's an interesting question. I think that there's no function at it. So in Islamic theology, Jesus is the Messiah. And everything could have gone down the road as a messianic victory if he was accepted, right? So a week ago, what happened? A week ago, Palm Sunday, right? He was greeted as a king, right? And then by Thursday, he's betrayed, right? And put on trial.
Uh-huh.
So I think that the idea of the restoration or the idea of how things could have moved, changed in that period of time between his greeting as a king and the greeting as a king. And then from there, the acceptance as the Messiah, but that didn't happen. So the purpose of the cross, it doesn't really exist. There's no real there's no symbolism behind it. It would be considered idol worship. And it's the priesthood of Azadisa that's really important. Restoring the law. That's the most important thing that Azadisa does within the Islamic structure.
So you could almost... It sounds like you're saying that if you're looking at things from the perspective of Good Friday.
Is this Good Friday? Is it Good Friday?
Yeah. Jesus was on track to fulfill the purpose of the Messiah, but got derailed by the circumstances leading to the crucifixion.
Yes.
What would have happened if that hadn't happened? If Jesus had been able to continue with what he was doing, what would have changed?
It's an interesting prospect, because all good Muslims need to have four books: the Torah, Psalms, the Quran, and
the Injil.
Yep. And so, which is difficult, because that's the New Testament, that's the speakings of Jesus. So you're right at that point where the Injil, but all the Injil and the Quran only exist because of what happened with his non-acceptance as Messiah.
Right.
So, which is treacherous, right? So you have to look at the reason why peace be upon him, the prophet came. All right, so it's the last prophet, right? So Muhammad, why is he has to restore the covenant, right? So that's what it's all about. So if you look at this from a perspective of Abrahamic lineage, you know, so you have like the one God concept, right, is really Zoroastrian, but then you have the word of God, right? It is of Allah, comes to us from the Torah, and that's the law. And then Christianity is sort of like restoration of the priesthood, right? And then so from there you have Islam, which is the prophet, the bloodline to the end of days, right? And but it starts with this idea of the living word of Allah, the living word of God, the Quran, right? Which then says all these things mattered, people of the book, up to now. And then we're at a point of critical mass where something extraordinary has to happen, right? You have to have a language that unifies everybody regardless of borders, Arabic, right? We need to have a living word of God, a living word of Allah, right? So here, this is it now. This is period, triangle around it. Then you need to also have an example to the end of days, which is the bloodline. So that's the prophet. These people have a little family. And so all that is necessary because of what transpires at Palm Sunday to Good Friday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Easter, maybe, I don't know. But Good Friday, Easter really doesn't really matter. So you know, it's difficult to say, oh, well, the crucifixion doesn't matter. It really doesn't. There's no purpose in it. And the idea of someone paying for the sins of another is just ridiculous in Islam. It's ludicrous. And the idea of Allah imposing you're imposing some kind of tariff on you once you're born is weird. Like, none of that stuff really exists. Everybody has a fair shake. Everybody has the opportunity to perform at birth. But once they hit seven, that's when you're sort of responsible, 7 to 12, when you're responsible in Islam.
So it's equivalent to what is in evangelical circles called the age of atonement.
Yeah,
age of accountability.
Yeah,
age of atonement. Sorry, I was thinking about the atonement.
So
that's the word that popped out.
Yeah, so you wouldn't have somebody pay for, you wouldn't have somebody pay for your sins. You wouldn't have. There's a number of things that you wouldn't have, and so like these things just don't jive. But the idea is that it sets in motion an opportunity for the Jewish Jesus movement to do something, and that gets derailed because then you have our buddy Paul, right, and who discards the law and works within the Gentile community. And then you have the Jewish Jesus movement under James.
And I was going to say,
James happens to lose his head.
I mean, what the precedents that you're referring to Islam as having established in the 7th century, 6th century?
Yes, 6th century.
6th century?
Real 7th century, yeah.
Yeah. Are the same precedents that were established by the Roman Catholic Church in the 5th or 4th century, establishing a priesthood, a hierarchy, establishing a common language, which in this case would be Latin.
Right.
And all that was done. The difference is that for Islam, what is a confounding weakness, this question of the cross, for certainly Roman Catholicism, if not all of Christianity, is its defining strength. It strikes me as, I don't know how else to put it, profoundly sad that this crucial moment in history should be viewed by Islamic faith as an inconvenience to be dismissed.
Well, I think you're kind of putting the words in my mouth. I don't think it's an inconvenience. It's all right. It's only an inconvenience because a Roman emperor decided to adopt Christianity and make it the state religion, and idol worship they were very passionate about, and no matter how many ways you try to get away from it, that's kind of what it is. And so the problem is that the God king emperor god became, and Christianity became very convenient buddies with Constantine onward. And so, you know, you had tremendous diversity within the Christian church prior to that. And even after that with the Inquisition. I mean, the Inquisition was largely a stamping out of diversity within the Catholic Church. And then futzing around with the Church of the East and some of the other places. But, and so the diversity in theology and Christianity existed throughout the life of the church. So where the crucifixion became inconvenient internally in many cases, and what the Trinity meant became inconvenient in many cases, I think it's more of an eternal matter to the Christian church. Islam looks at it very, very like straight lines. The priesthood of Hazrat Isa is where it's at. If there is no original sin, if there is no closing of heaven, if there is no, then, and the covenant still exists, which I think that's, I think it's very inconvenient for Christians to believe that the covenant, it's like Judaism, the covenant always exists with the Jewish community. So it's this, and the same thing with Islam. It's very convenient to establish a theology where you decide that the covenant doesn't exist, or that all the rules, that all the things laid out by Allah, by God, doesn't exist, or is not applicable to you. And then you overlay it with an empire. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, you're kind of, you're swimming in the mammon world. You know what I mean? You're just kind of futzing around with that now. And so you're trying to, you're with empire and, you know, taxes and gold and all this other stuff, and discarding all this stuff while you're establishing a theology that fits with the crucifixion. I think the crucifixion is very inconvenient for the Christianity. And that's why you have to cobble together this Trinity. You have to cobble together a number of rituals associated with it and symbolism associated with it. Well, you have to keep talking your way through it and explain it.
I don't think you can fairly say that the crucifixion is inconvenient for Christianity, because Christianity is the crucifixion. If you have a theology, just let me finish.
Yeah.
If you have a theology in which Jesus had a purpose which was derailed by the crucifixion, then it's an inconvenience. If you have a theology in which the purpose of Jesus was to be crucified, that was his ultimate purpose and mission, then I don't think that you can fairly say that it's an inconvenience. It's everything.
All prophets,
it's the crux of the theology.
All prophets are persecuted, or most prophets are persecuted one way or another. There's always, look, you know, Moses never was able to reach the promised land. It's on brand.
Right. So if you're looking at it from what we would call that Old Testament perspective, yeah, I totally follow. I totally trust.
That's what I mean by it's not inconvenient.
What I'm trying to say is that there's a fundamental distinction, which is what you're alluding to, is the break between that distinction, where you're saying, okay, up until this new kind of theology, there was a fairly straight line in terms of what is a prophet, what is a covenant,
right?
What is, you know, the relationship between man and God, what are the rules and stuff like that. And what sticks in your craw is that what you would define as like Pauline Christianity cuts that off and says, no, now there's something completely new that has nothing to do with what came before.
I mean, it's a fantastic innovation. I'm not going to devalue the innovation in it. But if God is one thing, it's very consistent with a hammer. This is how it is. This is what's going on. Here are the rules. Don't have to follow them. But guess what? Here they are. And here they are very explicitly. And culminating in the Quran, which is 97% of the Quran is just how to live, how to do it right. You could do it wrong if you want. It's up to you. But this is how to do it right. And you don't have to believe that that's right. It's fantastic. But this is it. And it's completely in alignment with the laws of Moses, the laws of Abraham. So it's a straight line. I think that the innovation of the crucifixion is profound. I mean, it's created a whole world religion. The challenge is that maybe there's a better way for me to explain it. If the crucifixion is very clunky, right? It's very hard to explain to someone. And once you start going down the rabbit hole of why he needed to be crucified to a non-Christian. And I think most Christians are confused by it too. Can't explain it. If a rabbi who said follow the law wanted to do something innovative and unquestionably profound in alignment with Christian thought, why go crucifixion? Why not just turn around and say, you want to know what? I'm going to eliminate all sickness. Everybody lives to 110 years old. If you sin or something like that, then fine. But that would have, there would have been unquestionably no way for any, everybody would have been on board and everyone would have known what happened, period. Okay. So what Islam explains is the victimhood of Jesus while, and the derailment of the messianic mission in simple terms, without any kind of strange, clunky event related to something that's otherworldly, which can be seen as an innovation, which can be seen as profound. But the idea is this is in alignment with everything that's happened before, and it sets the stage for what's going to happen. And right then and there, there was a responsibility within the Jewish Jesus movement to maintain the priesthood of Hazrat Isa, and they didn't. What happened was they discarded the Injil. They got rid of the priesthood of Jesus, and they created something different. And that something different really needed to be explained and worked out. And you can see that from the beginnings of Paul all the way through to the codification of the canon. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's not in alignment with the laws of Moses and the laws of Abraham, period, from an Islamic perspective. And I would say, I don't want to speak for the Jewish community, but I think from the Jewish community's perspective either. Once you start cobbling together empire and start cobbling together, which is exactly what's happening right now with Israel, right? So the problem with Israel right now, and this is a really kind of good, is you're overlaying Judaism into a country, right? An empire, a nation. And whether it's right or wrong, I'm not making a judgment. It's, you know, that's not right now. For the purposes of the conversation, what happened with Rome and Christianity is happening right now in real time with Israel and Judaism. So the big debates online, you know, Zionism is the same as Judaism or not, right? Does Israel have the right to exist? But saying whether Israel has the right to exist, someone might say that there's criticisms that it's anti-Semitic. Well, if you say no, because then you're saying Judaism doesn't need to exist. And like I said, I'm not making a judgment on that. What I'm saying to you is that you're seeing what happened with Christianity in Rome in real time with Israel and Judaism and Zionism and nationhood. You're seeing it. The confusions that happen with theology, the confusions that happen with how you establish, maintain a community of faith and maintain a nation, a temporal nation that's trying to defend itself, collect taxes, provide healthcare, and all these other things. Meanwhile, jockeying for space and for agency within a world of nations, right? And so the problem is all this stuff was dealt with throughout Abrahamic theology, but specifically with Jesus, right? The temptations and all that business in the wilderness, that you'd be in charge of this and that, you'd be a king of the world. You know, all those things you wrestle with as a community of faith when you're dealing with the temporal world, right? The laws of man, right? As opposed to the laws of God. And so it's happening in real time, and you can see it with Israel, right? And to a certain degree, you can see it in America, the idea of a Christian nation, the idea of some of these people in Congress that are, you know, talking about how they're I'm with Jesus, right? And so I think I sent you a clip on that. So I think that there's an opportunity here to kind of look at it from that perspective. I'm a religious freedom guy. Freedom to believe, to not believe, to change, to choose. Believe whatever you want. I really don't care. But I'm one of these guys that's like a straight line guy. And because I'm Shia, because I'm Ismaili, I have this idea of the bloodline to the end of days. And so you need three entities. You need the Mahdi, you need Hazrat Isa, and you need a member of the bloodline, and a mom that's related to Hazrat Muhammad, right? So you need three entities in my theology, right? And they all make sense. One is the bloodline. Well, one is is part of the bloodline, the Mahdi, but he's also that's our temporal guy that's going to do the stuff that no one else can do. And then you have Hazrat Isa, who's the prophet that's going to come, that has the special abilities, that's imbued with the power of Allah to do things, right? And that's to counteract the Dajjal. So it's completely in alignment with. Now, I think something extraordinary happened with Hazrat Isa's priesthood. And I think all Muslims do. Hazrat Isa's Torah spoken about in the Quran quite often. So, but it talks about this effort to restore the law and just trying so hard to make that happen. And that struggle is it's like a slow burn. It's worse than the crucifixion. It's worse than the seven pillars, or what's that? The things of the cross, stations of the cross.
Stations of the cross.
It's worse. It's worse because we're at a critical point where everything is on the line. And it's that decision by the community at that time to devalue, demote, and essentially create a different path for Hazrat Isa. So, and all of person kind.
After his ascension? Is that what you're referring to, the course that Christianity took after Jesus?
Well, once he's not accepted as the Messiah, once he's not there to restore the law, then immediately it becomes okay. And so you have to pull Hazrat Isa out, because his prophetic nature, prophetic message was not received in a way in which it was meant.
So a couple questions come up for me.
And maybe there need to be a pharaonic thing, like with Moses. Maybe there need to be plagues and stuff. I don't know why that didn't happen.
One thing I'm curious about in what you're saying is, who, in Islam, who is held more responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus, the Roman Empire or the Jews? And the second question is, had those events not transpired, what would Jesus have done?
This is an interesting question. Well, I don't know if, I think responsibility, that's an interesting question. So what's, who's responsible for, I don't know if the question is appropriate. So it's not like who's responsible for the crucifixion. It's the messianic message wasn't received by the people.
Which people? The Jews?
Everyone's Muslim. So that's why when someone converts, they're called a revert.
And this was also true in Jesus's day.
It's true because that's what Islam is. So this is one of the immovables. So the idea is, if you have a holy man, you have a rabbi who's trying to restore the priesthood, or the word, the law, and his community is the Jewish community, they don't accept it. That in itself, because of a myriad of things, right? And I would argue, the argument is that just like we're talking about statehood and personhood and all this other stuff right now, I was talking about Israel and the Jewish community, essentially it became a secular, Israel at the time was struggling with its identity within the Republic, right? There was a puppet government. There was all kinds of other things going on. And so the Romans have very little to do with it, I think. You're trying to pin me down, I think. And so the community has lost its way. There's a holy man a prophet that's trying to put them on the right track, and they reject the prophet, which is on brand, happens all the time in Abrahamic theology. And that's where it's at. Crucifixion, that's happens later on down the road. Once they've already made the decision, nothing really after that matters. Because in order to fulfill the laws of Moses, the laws of Abraham, and the prophetic word, right? You have to bring that Jesus has to fulfill his what he's tasked with. And that's now going to come later.
So Jesus's purpose was to restore the law. And since he was rejected by the Jewish people that he was preaching to when he came to Jerusalem, that mission was not accomplished.
Right, but I wouldn't say it was the Jews who did it. I wouldn't say that. I think that's like pejorative.
It was the people around him.
It's
just in general the milieu.
The people, everyone is Muslim, right? Everyone has the ability to come on board at that critical moment in time. And for some reason, it all didn't come together. Is that providential? I don't know. Was all part of a plan? It all has to do with the choice that was made by those people at that time.
If you were to imagine a world in which Jesus was not crucified, in which he lived, would his function then have been to point forward to Muhammad?
It's an interesting question. Right. You know, as a faith scholar and as a Muslim, I'm going to say this like my words are my own, because there's a lot of nerds out there that probably have done a lot of research on this, but from a theological perspective, Muhammad had to come because there was no, the Abrahamic faith had to get back on track. And there was a specific need for him and for the word to be brought down in the idea of the Quran. To answer your question, Everything could have been changed at any time within the Abrahamic timeline. And the purpose of Muhammad comes only after a series of failures within the covenants with Allah.
So in a perfect world, I know we're as close to perfect as possible, the covenant is observed, and the proper balance of relationship between God and man under the sun is in effect. And then
the covenant could be fulfilled with Hazrat Isa. Is that what you're saying? You know, in that moment, yes, can be fulfilled with Hazrat Isa.
In the sense that
we had something extraordinary happen.
Let me just, there's one other thing that I'm kind of wondering about here.
And this is an unpracticed conversation. This is one of those things where you just kind of threw the question at me, but yeah.
We take this into the eschatological realm, and there's this understanding that Hazrat Isa with the Mahdi, with the Imam, create this fulfillment in which the apocalypse then takes place.
Right.
And that's like the end of time, the end of days.
Right.
Right.
And you need that triad because of what happened with Hazrat Isa.
Is that the ultimate purpose of God in the sense that were Jesus to have fulfilled his role successfully, would the end of days have taken place during his lifetime?
Short answer is yes. Long answer would be what that looks like or what that looked like. I don't know. That I don't know. But the fulfillment of the covenant would have happened. And so, you know, if everyone would have been in alignment with the law, and God would have been happy. And I'm going to say the restoration, whatever that means, would have been established. And there wouldn't have been an Antichrist. There wouldn't have been any of that business. There wouldn't be a need for Hazrat Isa's return to counteract the Antichrist. There wouldn't mean to be a Mahdi who is walking around with a group of Muslims all over the world saying, it's time, and converting everybody in or bringing everybody into the fold. And there wouldn't have, and then the idea of the moment of time, the member of the bloodline coming down and establishing themselves as a religious scholar, a theological scholar on the planet to arbitrate over the word. None of that stuff would be necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So Hazrat Isa has a very special place in Islam because it's sort of this tragic chapter of where we had it. We were like on the precipice of it. And, you know, it's, you know, paradise lost.
Why in Islamic theology is it unacceptable for a prophet in his role to die?
It's not, but he has a role to fulfill.
And if he dies, he can't fulfill that role.
Correct.
Why?
That's just them's the rules. That's just how it works.
You're going to have to do better than that.
What do you mean?
Why? Why is death the end? Why does death preclude him from fulfilling his purpose?
Because then once you death, then you have to, then it's judgment, right? So then it starts a whole nother realm.
And so no one can...
That's the law.
No one can move from the realm of death back into the realm of life.
I'm not going to say that. I really don't. you know, I'm not going to weigh into whatever, you know, I'm not a prophet, beloved of God, so I don't really know of what can and cannot happen. Everything is possible and nothing is possible. So, but in this case, his role is intact, and there's no reason for his death. There's no purpose in it. And because he's a prophet, beloved of God, then his role is to fulfill that.
Yeah, that's just what strikes me as so sad is you imagine being an apostle or a disciple in the time of Jesus, and literally or figuratively, you're looking at this man hanging on this cross whom you had labeled the Messiah, the chosen one of God come to restore God's kingdom on earth. And you're looking at these shreds of flesh hanging from the cross, and you're wondering, what is this? What does this mean? And there's two basic choices. Either it means something, or it means nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's conflated by the fact that for 40 days afterwards, Jesus is popping around, telling everybody I didn't die. So now it gets even worse, because now he and no one recognizes him. No one knows what's going on. I mean, by your own theology, and he's trying to convince everybody this is what's going on.
Things get weird.
It gets peculiar.
Yeah, things definitely get weird.
It gets peculiar, and you know what? And then you know, like you said, if I was going to take my theology out of myself, and I was just going to be, you know, give an intelligence assessment of what's going on there. It really is peculiar, the actions of the people around him and the actions of Jesus of Hazadisa. And forget about religion. It just, all the occurrences that happened during that time are very peculiar.
Yeah, and there is an inherent peculiarity to it.
Right.
It's cobbled together in a variety of vignettes that are hard to reconcile with each other.
And if you take the crucifixion, you take what happened this week, right? And you look at it from a completely secular, objective national security posture. That's what you're taking a look at it. And you're going, something is happening between a superpower, the Roman Empire, and one of their satraps of dissent, Israel. And you go, a rebel, a dissident, a counter-revolutionary is now put on trial. The only trial that's ever happened in the middle of Passover, never happened before since. That's something that would pop out as something extraordinary. So you'd say, why is that happening? You got a guy, Caiaphas, and we're looking back at this event, whose ossuary has the Jesus nails in it, presumably. You have a member, his brother, who's not a member of the Sanhedrin, James, but who is in orbit, in very close to that orbit, says nothing. All the votes are unanimous that he needs to die for the Sanhedrin. All of a sudden, James of Arimathea, this guy pops out. I think he was part of the Sanhedrin, but I'm not sure. Austin's donates his grave. Very expensive situation. There's this weird, you can pick this guy or pick that guy, you know, Barabbas, or you could do, there's this weird choice, which, you know, there's all these peculiarities that don't make sense. It's trial when a trial's never happened, a trial at night, in the middle of a holiday these things don't add up. And then all of a sudden you say, well, the guy shows up after the crucifixion and says, I didn't die.
No, he didn't say he didn't die.
I didn't die on the cross.
No, he died on the cross.
What does he say? Don't futz around with the words. He tells people I didn't die on the cross.
No, he says, I'm alive.
Same thing.
I've risen. I live. Okay. It's not the same thing. So that's I think where your Islamic theology is tripping you up.
It's not Islamic theology. That's okay. Christian theology.
Common sense is tripping you up. He did die on the cross.
No, so what you're trying,
and he's not dead.
No. You're trying to do is I'm looking at it from a secular right now, a secular evaluation, right? That's what I was saying. What you're trying to do now is inject theology into that secular evaluation. And you're trying to say it's Islamic, and that's not true.
I concede. If you don't want to have a theological conversation, then
no, that's not your point. No. See, you're playing with the words. So I said, if you're looking at it from a national security stance, and you're looking at it from a superpower, okay, and a satrap that's in descent, and you're looking at the things that don't add up, right? That's the conversation right now, and the idea of someone on the back end saying, "Well, I didn't die on the cross, okay? I'm alive." Whatever you want to, however you want to couch it. Okay, so you know, it's all these semantics with you. So, but if you're looking at it from a testimonial element, right, and you're looking at it, it's showing up in an office in the Defense Intelligence Agency or the CIA, and someone's sitting in there as a secular individual that's got to evaluate this from an intelligence perspective. They're going to say, well, this guy obviously didn't die on the cross, and there's all these peculiarities. All these members of the inside have helped him through this crucifixion. It doesn't make sense. What's going on here? The net result is, well, he didn't die on the cross. The net result is that he had conspirators that assisted him through this process, right? You know, and what happened? And then you could meddle into like sort of the, well, he was given mandrake and he passed out and that's why he died so fast, you know, and you could go through this whole evaluation from a secular perspective, right? From a non-theological perspective, and you can kind of get into that. And that's, you know, that's my world, right? If I was going to take the theology out of myself. When it comes to Islam, we don't go that, you just don't go any farther. You don't need to go any farther than he was there to restore the word. He was there to restore the law, and he didn't. There's no theological argument beyond that, because it doesn't need to be, because that's what his prophetic mission was.
What's demonstrated by Christianity is that if you can make the cognitive leap and invert the meaninglessness, then it's creates something so powerful that it's literally shaped to the world in its aftermath.
What shaped the world is the Romans adopting Christianity. It's not the crucifixion. You're completely off base on that. You're a victim of Roman adoption of Christian theology. And the problem is you're trying now to retroimpose that importance on the crucifixion.
No.
It doesn't work.
Rome was just another empire.
It wasn't just another empire.
What made it special was that despite all the obfuscation and mutation and destruction of the essential theology, there is within the concept of a meaningful crucifixion. Something so powerful that it cannot be conquered.
Rome became a church. It became the Vatican. It's still in existence. You're still a victim of the overlay.
And I'm telling you, that's why. Because
it's an institution.
If you go,
and you are part of the byproduct of that institution, regardless of you coming from the Reformation, you still are an appendage of that institution, of that bureaucracy, and you still are of Rome, period. And no matter how many ways you shake it, the profound nature of Rome's not only adoption, but shaping of Christianity is what you believe.
So
the Bible you have is a product of that. And it's still governed by the church.
Do I understand correctly that what you are saying to me is that I may believe that I have been affected profoundly by the theology of the cross, but in fact, I am fooling myself, and what has shaped and affected me profoundly is actually something else entirely, an institution.
An institution, a god, a god emperor, and that god emperor still exists in your mind. And here's the thing, there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe you're right. Maybe it is providential that Rome adopted everything and that the Catholic Church is what it is. Or orthodoxy is what it is. Maybe that's all the way. Great. I'm more than willing to concede that, but I don't believe it.
Explain to me then.
But I think that you are a victim of the God King the God King concept.
Okay.
I think you can't separate. Hold on. This is what I said to you. You can't separate what's the evolution of the Christian doctrine. Okay. From which is retroactively storytelling on the cross, retroactively doing that. So the confusion of the crucifixion, the confusion, like you said, either it means nothing or it means something. The meaning of something didn't just happen overnight, and that's what you're trying to argue. You're saying that it was when it happened. That's not true. We know that it was an evolution of theology that was packed and unpacked and crafted over the course of centuries that led to what you believe. That's very, very different than what you're saying.
Rather than taking that bait, I want to circle back to something that you were saying, which is that...
That's the lead-in. That's exactly the lead. Rather than taking that bait, I would rather talk about...
Well, no, because you said something that I want to unpack a little bit more, which is that what I'm compelled by is this notion of the God King. And I want to ask you, what to me is compelling about the God King? Why am I so attached to that image? Why is it important to me?
I think it's salvation, right? I don't know. You have to tell me what you think. I don't know what you think.
The ball is in your court. You're telling me that you understand my motivations. And so you have to explain.
No,
to
I'm not. No, that's not what I said. What I'm trying to say to you is that as someone from the outside, right? I come from a multi-faith family, right? So I'm members of the family that are Catholic. So I understand that pretty well. I've been in the multi-faith space for a long time. I'm explaining to you more of why I don't believe. All right. Why I'm not on that Christian track. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just like how you look at me. Right. No matter how many ways you slice it, you're not going to jump on the Islamic train. I'm not trying to Islam you, and I'm not trying to un-Islam you. Right? That's not my thing. I could care less. But I'm sort of a victim of the idea that a prophet can come around at any time. Right? Just like Moroni with the Mormons, or Muhammad with the Muslims, or Joe Smith, with the Mormon, and or any of the other, you know, people, you know, Jim Jones, right? Anybody can come and claim, you know, the guy from Wake Up, right? So you see me as a victim of that sort of condition, right?
Yeah, I was thinking,
but I know you're not imposing that on me, right? So as like the way I think, right? So it's the same thing with you. So it's an unarguable point, right? Unarguable that the crucifixion created much confusion at the time. And there was an evolution of thought. There was an absence. There was a vacuum of thought. And there were all kinds of people clamoring to figure out what happened. The Gnostics, you got the, you know, this, what was it? The Church of Light? What were the Dead Sea Scrolls? What were those guys called?
The
Church of the Sun. The Church of the Sun?
The Essenes.
Yeah, but they're the Sons of Light or something like that.
Sons of Light sounds like that might be.
Yeah, you know, like, you know, you got these.
They're Sadducees.
Yeah, how cool is that? You have these sort of think tanks formed all over the Middle East, the Mediterranean, trying to unpack what happened with the crucifixion.
Why? Why did it matter? Why did they care?
Well, just wait a while. But here's the thing. We'll get to the why. But the point is that you say, why did they care? There was diversity of thought that ended up aggregating into what is mainstream. Okay. And so Rome assists with that. The Catholic Church assists with that. And that becomes the bureaucracy, right? Who's to say that none of that, that one of the guys that was killed off or died off wasn't right? And that's what I mean, right? I feel like there's a victimhood that goes towards this idea of you had to have a religious overlay to fortify Rome. And it worked. It worked for a little bit. And then Rome became the church. It's not that Rome disappeared. Rome became the church. It became a church. It became a bank. And then what ended up happening then is you had this line moving, and then you had enough critical mass where the Reformation happened, right? And you had enough critical mass where, well, you had the way back in the beginning where you had the Great Schism, and then you had Orthodoxy. So you have an evolution of the theology, which is fantastic. And maybe that is providential. Maybe that's prophetic in itself. I don't really know. I'm just not on board with it. It's too clunky. It's too confusing. And then imposing this idea on the crucifixion, saying, well, this is it now because we decided it, is different than it being it. So you can turn around and say whatever you want about Hazrat Muhammad, right? There's a cave, there's Gabriel, there's a book that's established, right? There are actions that come after that. There are people surrounding him. There are events surrounding him. And there's a process, just like the bureaucracy of the church, to verify what is the Sunnah, what is the Hadith. There's an idea of how the Prophet lived. All right? And that bureaucracy exists. And it creates good and bad. It creates different schools of thought that go down to fundamentalism and different schools of thought that go down the road of following the word, following the law. And so the clarity that came out of the Quran can be corrupted. So Islam is not immune, right? But one of the innovations is that we don't go back to the cave. We don't go back to Muhammad, and we don't say, and keep ruminating over what happened. This is what happened. This is what set it in motion. And we are victims of the interpretation and the arbitration because we're trying to balance the laws of man with the laws of God on a regular basis. When it comes to Christianity, there appears to be quite a bit of laws of man interference with the law. Starting with Paul. Paul opening the door and say, discard the law. Paul opening the door, and his evolution of thought, his connection to the Sanhedrin, his connection to apostles, and then how that gets moves and evolves into a very Romanesque, a very Gentile movement. Maybe that's the way it is supposed to be. I don't really know. But there's an evolution of that. Do I think you're a victim of it? You're getting caught in the word victim. Do I think you're the beneficiary of it? Maybe that's a better way of saying it. Maybe you're a beneficiary of this well-thought-out line of judiciously looking at theology and the crucifixion. And you want to know what? Christianity just figuring it out and then saying, Trinity, crucifixion, this. Maybe you are. I really don't know. But the problem is there's just as many arguments on the other side within Christianity. And that's what's... It's always confusing and clunky to an outsider. And I'm close to the inside. You know, I benefit from a family that had an Islamic tradition and a Christian tradition, right? I benefit from that. So I swim in those waters really, really good, you know? And I even have, my aunt is Jewish and my two cousins are Jewish. So we you know, and I grew up in a Jewish community. So I benefit from that, the ideas around it. And I even said, I even worked with my family to try to figure some of this stuff out. I went to a Catholic college, Marist. And that's good and bad because then I have blind spots with anything that's on the reform side I lived in Russia, so it maybe not so much the Orthodox side, but Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, I'm a little confused about, but Russian Orthodox I got. So I think that, you know, maybe you are the beneficiary of this long lineage of judiciously looking at the theology and events and then sitting there going, we figured it out. But the problem is that within your own community, forget about Roman Catholicism and forget about Eastern Orthodoxy. Within the evangelical community, there's such diversity of thought and disagreement.
But there's one common agreement. There's one thing that we all agree on, and that's Christos Anesti. Christ is risen.
But then we get back to the idea of, it was not apparent to the apostles that had happened. He's on the cross.
You're trying to make
it. As you say.
You're trying to make a historical case, and that's not the conversation.
I'm not making a historical case. In your own words, Either it means nothing or it means something. It just wasn't apparent in that moment by the apostles in their observation that this was a resurrection, that this was something that was supposed to happen. And therefore, at that moment, something had to be either, you had to make that leap. It either means something or means nothing. And you really don't want it to mean nothing. So it sets in motion now this idea that something has to be created from nothing. And then saying after you've created it that it means everything and it's unifying is still post. So that's the problem. That's where I have the issue. And like I said, you know, maybe the confusion is providential, as you would say, you know, as a Christian would say, maybe it's all part of it, but I don't believe that. It's like at the Last Supper, Hazrat Isa could have been like, you want to know what? Let me tell you what's going to happen.
That's what he did. Read the Gospel of John.
Yes. So he says, I'm going to be resurrected, right? He says, this is what's going to happen, right? And it either means something or nothing.
it, according to the gospel, he actually tells his apostles what's going to happen, and they kind of ignore him, and they don't realize until later.
And when was when was John written, and who wrote it? See, you go down this rabbit trail, and who wrote it, and is John closer to the source or farther away from the source, like Luke or one of the other books?
That depends on how you interpret it.
No, but there. So stop right there. Now we're in the
right. Now we're in the weeds, and so I'm trying to stay like.
No, but when you say that Jesus said it, no, he didn't. Okay, no, he didn't. Okay, so what you're doing is you're saying John says that Jesus said it, and that's the difference, because we know what happened at the crucifixion. We know what happened prior to the canon. We know what happened. We know that there was this arbitration of where does Jesus fit? Where does the crucifixion fit? Who are we? And you want to know what? There's nothing wrong with that. Maybe that's part of the prophetic. Maybe that's part of the providential element of Christianity. And maybe it's all right.
You're very animated about this, and I'm trying to understand what there seems to be.
You asked me the question. I thought we were going to talk about Cadbury eggs. I was going to say, how many eggs do you need to eat in order for Jesus to be satisfied? That was the question that I asked you when I came in.
The aspect that you are presenting to me looks as if you are trying to address a wrong or an injustice.
No, I just haven't had a conversation like this in a while. You and I usually have this conversation offline over a bagel.
I know.
And then we goof each other back and forth. So yeah. It's for us to capture it is fantastic, and I think that we're not against each other. That's the beauty of it. We're good friends and colleagues and so I don't get jazzed up. I get because I'm trying to prove anything. I get jazzed up because my normal day we don't have these conversations. In the IRF movement, in the International Religious Freedom Movement, we don't have these conversations. Mm-hmm. When it comes to faith communities talking, faith engagement in the modern world means everybody says we're all similar, we're all great, and we all, respect each other. We can all respect each other and still debate, and not have like sort of a gotcha thing, mm-hmm. So when you say like you're animated and you're this, how. It's just fantastic to kind of unpack and think out loud and know that I'm not going to offend you, and know that I'm not trying to convert you, and know that I'm not trying to have a gotcha moment. I'm not trying to have a gotcha moment. This is more of an internal sort of like, I haven't thought about this for a while. Now that you asked the question, let me see if I can unpack this. I know I'm self-incriminating. I don't know how many of my friends are going to listen to this, or people are going to listen to this and go, God, but the thing is the challenge. These challenges are real, and the beauty of the Quran, the beauty of Islam, is that it sort of settles it all. Maybe that's the beauty of the Church of Latter-day Saints. They settle it all. I don't know. They've got a later prophet. They got Joe Smith. So, I believe in the straight lines, and those straight lines. And I don't believe in discarding or devaluing the word of God, the word of Allah. And I know the Torah is one of the immovables. So I get very, very nervous. I'll just be honest with you. I just get very, very nervous about the Torah being discarded. I get very, very nervous about that and the laws. And so when the Jewish Jesus movement evolves with Paul or evolves with James, I think James had it right. I think Paul had it wrong. And so Muslims are really big on bloodlines. So if James was part of the bloodline, then he was empowered to continue the Jewish Jesus movement. And so in that respect, you could say, I can remember like that's the moment where James is like, look, I need to govern. We need to govern this way. And I think that's proto-Islam. In the sense of codifying Islam as a faith that comes later, that needed to come later, even though everyone's Muslim.
what struck me about the line of conversation that you followed was your concept of the God King and your assertion that what is in fact compelling about Christianity in essence is this notion of the God King took place with the merge of Jewish theology with Roman Empire. And in that particular point, I don't think that you could be more wrong from my perspective. The notion of a God King is very compelling. And I would say that what drives most religious conflict is the conflicting differences between visions of a God King, this notion that there is a God who is waiting until some point at which he will come and set things right and exact justice and vindicate the righteous and punish the unrighteous. Mm. And one thing that we love to do in religion is identify ourselves with the righteous and fantasize what it will be like when righteous people like me are vindicated and what it will be like when unrighteous people are punished. And that's this kind of messianic sort of religion, right? There is a strong element of that within Christianity, and we see that manifesting itself in sort of the Zionist thought, for example, that we're seeing in with American politicians, where there's this notion of the eschatological return being facilitated by a certain sequence of events, and there's going to be collateral damage, but that's just the way that it is, and stuff like that. But underneath that, the point that I'm trying to make is underneath that, the fundamental power that makes Christianity what it is not that thing. That's something that's superimposed on top of it. That's an interpretation. Beneath it is something else. The historicity of many of these things, including the canonical value of various texts, is very much an open question. We can say that among the texts that are attributed to Paul, 1 Corinthians seems very likely to be one of the authentic ones. So in 1 Corinthians, Paul says, "When I came among you, I came determined to know nothing except Christ and him crucified."
Right.
And it's interesting to me that he didn't say Christ and him resurrected. He said Christ and him crucified.
Right.
So what we're pointing to is not the resurrected God King as the crux, the core dynamic of this belief system. What we're pointing to is Christ on the cross.
Yeah, but you're very passionate to say that you couldn't be more wrong about this. Is Jesus God? Yes or no?
I think no.
Yes or no?
What I mean,
though, it's because he is.
Well, sorry, let me go back and explain what I said. What I feel that you're wrong about is your assessment of my motivations. That's all.
I'm not assessing your motivations. I'm just saying that if I'm using you as an example your motivations, I have no idea what your motivations are. I just know that when I look at any Christian within the modern day, I look at them as the evolution of this theology of these historical events, those that could be obviously verified, right? And then the idea that, you know, like you try to, well, in John, they say this, and it's like, okay, let's not muddy the water with hearsay and nonsense. Let's just, you know, like let's just focus.
Sorry, I keep laughing because you're like, let's not worry about the gospels.
Well, because a problem.
Obviously, if you're going to take that out of the equation.
Well, no, but you have to retro.
The conversation is extremely limited. And like,
it's not limited. It's not limited. Look, it's a point, and the point has value.
Yeah.
The challenge is like, which one of the gospels is closer to the source?
We know that John is very passionate about establishing these anchor points within the theological argument of heading towards the crucifixion. This is going to happen, and building the argument. We know that.
From a historical perspective, I agree with you in the sense that the function of John as a gospel is that it elevates and evolves theology to a more sophisticated point.
Right, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's exactly the argument. The point that I'm trying to make is like, hey, you know, it's an evolution. And so, I started this off with you being a victim, which was very pejorative. And then I said to yourself, maybe you're not a victim. Maybe I should change the word to maybe you are the beneficiary of, you know? So maybe you are the beneficiary. Maybe this is all the right line. I don't buy it. And the reason why I don't buy it is that there's so much explanation. They're not straight lines. It's always this convoluted, you know, pyramid scheme of having one thing rely on 10 other things that were said. And then on top of that, you're trying to build this whole argument. And the God King exists. You're saying that that Jesus was God. That's what you're saying. And so when you say you're like, you couldn't be more wrong. No, you want to say that the crucifixion is the end all be all, but then you want to say God died on the cross. And but then you say, you know, you don't want to, you kind of want to,
no,
shy away. Yeah. The God King complex concept is there. It exists. And the question within the crux of the matter with Islam, to answer your question, is you just don't think it's not possible for God to be man. Period. God cannot die. There's no reason for it. Because we rely on God's mercy. We rely on God's guidance. We rely on God to be there as the immovable. And there's no reason for him to separate himself. There's no reason for him to die. There's no reason for any of that stuff. But there's also no reason for him to turn around and say, I'm imposing this upon you forever. And guess what? Then I'm going to show up and I'm going to kill myself so that the thing I imposed on you, this sin, whatever it is, this access to heaven, now is removed so that now that you're forgiven for the thing that I imposed upon you. God, Allah gives you a fair shake from birth, period. That's it. And so everyone is in charge of their own destiny. There's no pyramid scheme of someone else paying for your sins or this or that. It's all arbitrated in a very direct line. The God King is real in Christianity. It just is. And like I said, there's nothing wrong with that if that's what you believe. But it just is. There's no argument out of that. And you can't say that the crucifixion is, because it's so important, it makes it insignificant. It doesn't make it insignificant. You can't kill God, period. That's it. And and I understand your argument. We had this conversation maybe 2 years ago where you were talking about, God coming, the beauty of God coming down and sort of condescending to being a person. You didn't use these words. I'm paraphrasing. And going through this trials and tribulations, and it humanizes God. God doesn't need to do that. We're of him. So that we don't have to do that. And you were talking about the beauty of that crucifixion, the beauty of that movement, that connection, that closeness. And it was a very, like, you know, sort of interesting conversation that we had 2 years ago about that. But it already exists without that. And that's the Islamic tradition. So it already exists. And the idea of relying on the beauty of a higher being that is given you the opportunity for fulfilling yourself and for working with all these other fellow, you know, people on the planet. That's the profound element, and it's completely in alignment with Hazrat Isa's priesthood. It's completely in alignment with that. It's just the problem is like you can't have God die. You can't have you need Hazrat Isa needs to fulfill whatever his mission is. There's just these immovables.
If Hazrat Isa dies, he can't fulfill the mission.
Well, if it's immovable, it's immovable. The Christian contention is that a God who is not willing to die is not worth believing in.
I mean, it just makes us, I don't even know what that means.
We could have lots of conversations about that. But you raised an interesting point. We're all victims of and beneficiaries of, in certain ways, the things that we believe. And it's an interesting way of looking at the season that we're in now, looking at this image of Christ on the cross. The Christian question is he a victim or is he a victor? And the Christian answer is both. And in the same way, we are both victims and beneficiaries of the religious traditions that we have inherited and adopted.
Yeah, and we're both swimming, equal partners, in trying to just get down the road. That's the problem, or that's the challenge. And so, I look at things very, like you said, we're victims and beneficiaries, like we kind of discussed, of our own theologies and family backgrounds and environments and all this other stuff. I don't know. Do I want a God who dies? Or do I want someone who I can always, that's always there, that's going to bring us to the next level?
Why not both? Why not both? Thanks, John. Get talking.
Yeah, I know.